All right. Yeah, to clarify what Venki just said, I haven't really moved in over the last 2 years, but our institute, which used to be the National Institute of Medical Research, is now becoming part of the Francis Crick Institute, sort of one of the most exciting biomedical enterprises in Europe, I think. Largest institute built, purpose-built directly next to a tube station, King's Cross, the busiest tube and train station in Britain. So we're going to be very exciting to be able to do electrophysiology directly next to that from next July on. All joking aside, it's going to be a great project. I'll show a beautiful picture in the very end. And yeah, and my original talk was taking a page from Peter Mombert's book, give the most generic title you can think of. He used to call his talks always targeting olfaction or coding olfaction. I said something inhibition olfaction. Now it turns out that the one thing I didn't want to talk about is inhibition. So I should learn more from Peter in that respect. I don't want to talk too much about inhibition because Izumi is giving a talk in the workshop next Tuesday or Wednesday. So and she's going to talk a lot about what she's been doing together with me over the last couple of years. So thanks a lot for having me here for that very exciting meeting and the exciting workshop for me to come over the next weeks. Thanks, Anne-Marie, Bob, Frankie, Alex, if he's anywhere. So what I'm going to talk today is a little bit more about rhythms and generally our vision, how what we try to understand. Oops. Apparently we're not understanding this. So a good thing about a meeting like this is that I think, you know, I don't have to give much of an introduction. We all share a certain passion to try to understand how, oops.
You have to give the talk.
Okay. So we all share a passion to understand how olfaction works, how odors are represented, how they are ultimately leading maybe to behavioral output. And for us specifically, we've been focusing on the early parts of the olfactory system, or main olfactory system, on the olfactory bulb. So more specifically, trying to understand odor representation in the olfactory bulb and how that leads to behavior, and also a little bit how behavior might influence that kind of odor representation. I'm not going to give much of an introduction. The olfactory bulb circuitry, we've seen that numerous times. Key thing for us is there are a bunch of projection neurons for most of the talk. I'm going to show recordings from those projection neurons. And as I said, there are various inhibitory circuits that, for the purpose of this talk, I'm largely going to ignore. So if one wants to understand odor representation and lead that to behavior, one could argue, and some in the audience are arguing that very heavily for the last many years, that one has to record an awake active animal. For reasons that I'm very happy to discuss in detail, we've been focusing on using whole cell patch recordings to do such recordings. In brief, the reason for us is that with the patch pipette, we just go in randomly into the olfactory bulb. We know roughly by depth where we want to record, but then we're just taking what we're given. Every lump of membrane we're recording, we're going to record. So we obviously have a bias for, let's say, larger lumps of membranes, maybe mitral cells, but within one class of neurons, we're going to take whatever we get, whether it's spiking or not. We're going to see every spike, and that sort of gives us, from one perspective, an unbiased view on what's happening in that preparation. So what Mihai Köhler, so for the first couple of minutes, I'm going to go through some published data and then embark on the stuff we've been doing more recently. So what Mihai has decided to do simply is try to record from mitral and tufted cells in the olfactory bulb in a way at fixed animal and see how are these cells spiking, how are they responding to odors. It's early morning, so to get you into the mood, this is a typical recording from an anesthetized animal, four different cells, mitral and tufted cells. We record, some cells show very, very low spontaneous firing, others show what we consider relatively high spontaneous firing, so 2 hertz maybe. But you get a variety of between barely anything and quite a few spikes. To our initial surprise, when we did this exactly the same approach in the way cat fixed animals, so this is an animal that doesn't have anything interesting to do but sits on a little treadmill that allows us to quite efficiently do patch recordings in these head fixed but sort of moving animals. We can also recover morphology. We can't recover morphologies as efficiently, maybe, as an anesthetized animal, but we can also record from cells. We're quite sure are mitral and tufted cells. And the picture that emerges is not so different from the anesthetized. We do see some cells that fire at a relatively high firing rate at a few hertz. others somewhat intermediate, but there are also quite a number of cells that essentially don't fire at all spontaneously, but you know, if we inject current, we can evoke spikes. I should, as an aside, say we're doing something quite similar to what John Backus said yesterday. So we've been reconstructing a small subset, or we're filling and reconstructing a small subset of neurons, and then do a cluster analysis on various electrophysiological features. But it turns out, as in your case, John, that the AHP is the most reliable predictor whether something's a protection neuron or something's an interneuron, in addition to input resistance, etc. So it's not particularly difficult to tell apart from an intracellular recording whether you record from a mitral tufted cell or from one of the interneurons. So we pool all this data from mitral and tufted cells as defined, as I just said. We do see quite a range of resting membrane potentials in anesthetized, and in the awake animal we don't see anything that looks that particularly different. If you overlay those two histograms, you do see that maybe in the awake animal there's something like a bit more of a spread. The cells tend to be maybe a bit more heterogeneous. You could argue maybe our recordings are a bit more wobbly in the awake, so maybe that is the heterogeneity. But if anything, it's not a massive difference between awake and anesthetized. Maybe the transition from anesthetized to awake results in a little bit more heterogeneity in membrane potential, but essentially I wouldn't call it a massive change. If we look at, pardon me? This was Kenningshausen. Yeah. If we do the same, looking at again at those distributions to run that point home, overall these distributions look pretty much identical. There are some deviations, as I said, the black being the awake compared to the blue anesthetized, more hyperpolarized and slightly more depolarized cells. If we translate that into firing rates, or if we just look at the firing rates, obviously we don't see much difference at the lower end. Cells that sit around here don't fire, whether they're more hyperpolarized or less doesn't make much of a difference. But we do see a larger populations of cells that fire at higher firing rates. So if we make a cutoff and just look at the top 10% cells or so, or top 20%, we would see quite a substantial difference. But overall, those populations are pretty much identical. So what about responses to odorants? Well, these are, again, just a small, admittedly hand-picked gallery of responses of cells in anesthetized animal to odorants, barely a response, maybe a little bit of an initial response with some long-off response, excited response, strongly excited response, etc. Do that in the awake animal, awake head fixed on a treadmill. See the same type of response, a bit of inhibition, maybe some small responses, barely a response, or initial response, and also sometimes a silent cell that actually spikes quite vigorously in response to an odorant. Again, looking at the population across a few hundred, or in many cases, a few thousand different trials, the overall, and I know this is a very crude picture, but just a kind of a bird's eye view on what's going on in the awake animal, you see that in the anesthetized, you see some significantly inhibitory responses, again using Z-scores like was discussed yesterday numerous times, or significant excitatory responses, and the overall global picture in the awake doesn't look particularly different. Some excited responses, maybe again a little bit larger of a spread. So in terms of phasic odorant responses, so this is all averaged across a 2-second period, I believe, there are quite similar phasic responses in anesthetized and awake animals. So just to make one thing very clear, I'm not saying the awake and the anesthetized state are identical. I'm definitely not saying that one shouldn't record in the awake animal. What I'm trying to say, and I will reiterate that probably 20 times over the next half hour, that the basic biophysics, the basic system, is not changing from the anesthetized to the awake. If you look at certain things that are probably going to be important, there are massive differences between the awake and the anesthetized. For example, the tail end of these distributions, that is probably a meaningful difference. But the global picture, the global network, the global biophysics, the global synaptic composition probably is the same. So it's, if we want to understand something mechanistically, if we get a deeper mechanistic understanding in the anesthetized, I think that is as valuable as getting a picture in the awake, what is going on during a behavioral task. So one thing that we found was drastically different from the awake, from the anesthetized compared to the awake, are these kind of long-lasting responses that are quite frequently seen in the anesthetized animal. If you take, these are two typical examples here, you give an odorant, it's quite faint actually, sorry for that, you give an odorant, you see a phasic response followed by a long-lasting, sometimes tens of seconds, increased firing rate. Actually, these increased firing rate might sometimes even follow a hyperpolarizing or barely a response. So it's not only kind of a sustained response, but it might also be some kind of off response. And those kind of things you don't see in the awake animal. And again, taking the bird's eye view to quantify these examples, if we just take all responses we ever measured in the awake animal, just average the change in firing rate over the first second, on average it's an increase in firing rate because cells don't fire very much, so on average they increase firing in these hundreds of older trials. And in the anesthetized, there's an increase of an average 1 to 2 hertz that stays, and even after 10 seconds, even if you average an entire 10-second period, you see an increase in firing rate of about 1 hertz across the entire population. In the awake animal, the picture initially is not too different, maybe even a slightly stronger response or so, but this is only a phasic response that is essentially over after something like 2 or 3 seconds. So over a 10-second period, there's a massive difference between the anesthetized response that across the population is robustly excitatory, and in the awake population, where over the entire population, there's no response. So if one focused on this 10-second period, like for example with sort of slower imaging methods, you would deduce that there's a massive difference between the awake and the anesthetized case. But if one focuses on the period that is, in my opinion, relevant for simple odor discrimination tasks like DEMA, like ZAC, like we have been looking at for some time, the first 200, maybe 500 milliseconds, the first sniff, the first two sniffs, potentially if I'm willing to compromise. If we focus at this particular period, there is no difference between those. If we average across 10 seconds, we see a difference, but that might be something that is, well, I don't know what is good for an anesthetized, but it's definitely nothing that's, I think, one should consider a massive difference between awake and anesthetized state. So overall, to finish this published part, overall there's quite similar activity and responses in the anesthetized and the awake. If I'm pointing now to the very differences, there's a slight increase in heterogeneity in the population of mitotufted cells in the awake. I wouldn't want to make too much about it. There's substantially fewer slow responses, but probably those slow responses in the anesthetized are anyway irrelevant for any odor discrimination because they happen at a time scale. They might be interesting for understanding what they are network-wise, but they wouldn't contribute to the behavioral decision. So, as I said, for me the message from these sort of sampling cells without caring about whether they spike or not is that overall the network is not particularly different between the anesthetized and awake. There are details that are really different, and these details might be quite important, but I think these are very relevant perturbations, but I don't think they fundamentally change how the network actually works. It's a shame that Diego Restrepo is not here. I think he was here last week or 2 weeks ago. So he wasn't here? He was supposed to be here 2 weeks ago. What he would say is, well, you know, this is nice, this is anesthetized, this is awake, but what is this dude doing? It's just sitting there, waiting passively for odorants being shipped into his nose, so it just won't care. So maybe the true difference actually happens when you're looking at an awake behaving situation. So more recently, we, and this is exclusively the work of an amazing grad student, Becky Jordan, we've looked at awake head fixed preparation. They're actually doing something. They're learning to discriminate an odor, and asked the question how that learning an odorant is actually potentially changing odor representation. So she figured out a relatively efficient prep. So from taking an animal from an animal house, implanting a head bar, to ultimately doing experiments, it's only a few days. I think the shortest maybe 5 days. Typically she's doing it 7 days. Two very brief training sessions to get the animal used to go/no-go odor discrimination task, and then we can do a patch recording while it's learning novel odor pairs. So the individual trial, the only thing I want to point out in the individual trial structure here is that we train the animal such that it responds with licking after the end of the odor presentation period. That is largely to make sure that the licking itself doesn't change, both mechanically as well as through some indirect link to sniffing, maybe change our measurements. Simple control experiment as well, comparing animals where we record, do a craniotomy, and where we don't record, red and blue, they seem to learn those odor pairs relatively similarly. And importantly, they learn actually these pair 2 and 3 during which we want to record within a few handful of trials, meaning within 20 minutes or so. How does such an individual trial look like? Well, this is just one example of an animal, blocks of 10 trials. So over the course of 50 to 80 trials, over the course of 20 minutes, reliably learns to discriminate between two odorants In this case, these are relatively broad mixtures, mixtures of odorants. It learns to discriminate from chance level starting to pretty much ceiling level performance. And these time scale 20 minutes is now one where we can actually do patch recordings reasonably well. So we can look at how does the animal respond, how does a microtuft cell respond to an odor early on or late during during the training phase. So in the how does the cell respond to an odor at the beginning, sort of in these first couple of trials? See that these are the two odors. Odor one, it's a brief one or two spike response, or the two are more sustained excitatory response. And after 20 minutes, pretty much these responses are not particularly changed. Again, these cells are still quite silent and rest, respond with one or two spikes, or respond with a burst of activity to the second odorant. So the message from this slide is simply, yes, we can record during a learning episode of 20 minutes. And the recordings are sufficiently stable that we can follow the same cells, same odor response over this 20 minute period. Is that always the case? Are always cells just not caring of whether the animal has learned something or not? Well, this is now a more detailed look into one of the experiments and the CS minus, the non-rewarded stimulus. Here we have the first five trials. I say kind of because we're dropping the very first trial, because as I come back to later in the very first trial, sniffing response is always very different, so it's kind of a hard thing to compare that trial to others. But during trials 2 to 6, it's quite stable, an initial response of a few spikes. And even during the later trials, 20 minutes or so later, maybe a subtle change, maybe a bit more bursty, but overall, globally, it still responds with a brief phasic excitation. And that shows also in the histograms, comparing the first five trials of firing to the last five trials of firing. However, for the CS plus trial, the rewarded stimulus here, the picture is quite a different one. There's a weak response at the very beginning and a quite strong response 20 minutes later. And again, this is the same cell. It's not that the cell got more excitable for whatever reason, but seemingly the response to this odor got substantially stronger. And again, can be seen, I think, most dramatically in the sort of firing red histogram. So we can have examples where there's a substantial change in the apparent odor response here, sort of averaged across the 2 second period, more than a doubling in the response to the CS plus, while the CS minus response stayed pretty much the same. Well, that's one example. How does it look across our population of recordings, approximately 20 experiments or so? Well, you know, it looks, on first glance, it looks pretty variable. Seems to be a general trend, maybe, that responses to the rewarded stimulus might be rather increasing and responses to the non-rewarded might be rather decreasing or staying the same. But the main thing is it's quite variable. Some cells, in some cases, there's a substantial increase in response over those 20 seconds. In some cases, actually, quite a substantial reduction in response. So odor representation, if we want to call the response of those cells to the odor representation, the olfactory bulb, changes during learning, but in a relatively heterogeneous or seemingly heterogeneous way. Similar picture, actually, when we look not at the firing rate, but look at the membrane potential. We have another point over here. Can anyone see that? Well, if we look at the membrane potential rather than the firing rate, membrane potential has the advantage we can decide, do we want to look at the first 100 milliseconds, 200 milliseconds, 500 milliseconds or so. We're not averaging across a 2 second period that, as we discussed earlier, is maybe not the most relevant for these simple discrimination decisions. If we look at the first 500 milliseconds after the first beginning of the first inhalation, after odor onset, we see again it's quite a variable. Some cells depolarize, others hyperpolarize, but there doesn't seem to be a massive difference between this plus and this minus trials. To look at the data from a slightly different perspective, give you an idea of how much things change. I'm plotting here the late response, so the average depolarization or hyperpolarization during the last trials, and the average hyperpolarization depolarization during the first trials. And you see overall, it's quite well correlated in a sense that, you know, in most cases, a strong response early is a strong response late, or a hyperpolarizing response early is a hyperpolarizing response late. That holds true both for the rewarded as well as for the non-rewarded stimulus. But, and this I think one can also see much better from this plot, there are examples where we're clearly deviating from this, maybe this point where several standard deviations away from line or these points, etc. So there are some cases where we get a significant change in responses, but for the majority, responses are relatively stable also during this learning context, from an odor not meaning anything to an odor being designated as rewarded or not rewarded. So a massive change in any non-olfactory component of the trials. So the first thing I would take from that is, again, you look in an awake behaving animal, it's not that responses are dominated by context or dominated by rewardedness or something. What they're dominated with is by the odor. That doesn't really change that much. But, you know, there's a little bit of a change, and we try to figure out where that potential little bit of a change comes from. You might have noticed that I put odor representation here in these inverted commas. The reason for that is that I think there are... Oh, sorry. So maybe this is an overview comparing in animals where they were just exposed to odorants and nothing happened. There was no reward, no learning, but the same trial. So only 10 examples. Not much changes over the course of the training. The variance, the spread of responses stays pretty much the same. Whereas in the active behaving case, turns out even early on, variability seems to be a bit larger, and that still increases over the course of learning. So there is some evidence that there's some kind of maybe diversification or some kind of change during these behaving. Why do I put odor representation in inverted commas? Well, I think there are two ways one can look at what's happening. My very naive view of what happens during training is, well, during early training, maybe there's a blurred odor representation, a poor odor representation in the olfactory bulb, and therefore recognition and the behavior is not so great. Maybe later on, after training, for some reason, representation in the olfactory bulb got better. Maybe there's centrifugal inputs that instruct that. Maybe they instructed learning, or maybe they have changed themselves. And that results in a better odor representation, and therefore maybe a better recognition. I think an alternative way to look at this would be to say, well, maybe the actual odor representation is not changing, but obviously some downstream structures, piriform cortex, all of a sudden figured out that one odor is rewarded and the other is not. So the change doesn't happen in the olfactory bulb. But what does happen is that after identifying an odor, sniffing changes, and this alteration in sniffing actually transforms how an odor is apparently represented. But this apparent representation happens after the animal has actually made a decision. So it's same representation, something is learned, then sniffing is changed, and after a long time, 200, 300 milliseconds after the beginning of the odorant, odor representation apparently changes because sniffing might have changed. If that's the case, then and these timescales, as I said earlier, so 200, 500 milliseconds. If that's the case, then any change in apparent odor response is not the cause of, and not causally relevant for the odor discrimination behavior, but just as a consequence of that, and for some reason the animal having altered its sniffing behavior. Why do you think sniffing is important? Well, because we all know sniffing has been the kind of key instructor for activity in the olfactory system, recognized, I guess, earliest by probably as always Lord Adrian, and this sort of prominently in the 70s, been shown that activity in the olfactory bulb is tightly locked to the sniffing cycle. Troy Margrie, a little tiny contribution of myself, looked at it from sort of intracellular perspective and saw that the membrane potential of mitre and tufted cells is reliably following that sniff rate. So what about the awake situation? Well, in the awake passive, something like 85% of cells are significantly sniff-coupled as well. But we wanted to focus on the behaving case, and we were quite surprised to see that, if anything, sniff-coupling, as measured by how well the membrane potential is linked to sniffing, is actually increased in the awake behaving animals, and you find quite robust oscillations quite often in the awake behaving animal. So sniffing, also in the awake behaving animal, seems to instruct activity in the early olfactory bulb. What you might notice here is I wrote that I'm focusing on sniffs between 200 and 300 milliseconds long. Why am I doing this? Well, the one difference that is particularly clear between an awake behaving and an awake passive animal is that the sniff length is quite different. It's quite more heterogeneous in the awake behaving animal. So these are for relatively random examples. An awake passive animal, most sniffs are between 200 and 300 milliseconds, whereas in an awake behaving animal, so that some sniffs are as short as 100 milliseconds. So we have a substantially larger spread. So if we want to compare how well sniffing instructs activity, we decided it makes more sense to restrict it to roughly the same sniff length. So that population data looks pretty much the same. So what now happens if sniff frequency actually changes? What happens to the response in mitral and tufted cells? Let's look at these two examples. This is a mitral tufted cell that's coupled, well coupled to sniffing. relatively low sniffing case, and then all of a sudden sniff frequency increased in that animal, no odor presented, that's just spontaneous changes in sniff rate. What happens to the mitocell membrane potential? In this case, it's substantially hyperpolarized by several millivolt with this increase in sniff rate. This other example here where sniff rate increases, the cell substantially depolarized. There seems to be quite some heterogeneity in how individual mitral and tufted cells respond to a change in sniff rate. And actually, if you look at a population of cells, it even seems that there are two subpopulations. Some cells depolarize in response to an increase in sniff rate. Some cells hyperpolarize in response to sniff rate. So any change in sniffing might result in larger heterogeneity or so in the responses we might get. Where can that come from? Where can that heterogeneity come from? As I've said a couple of times in the last day, I hate variability. I hate this kind of noise with a passion. And I think noise is not something given we have to accept. There's probably a reason why these are different. So what could that reason be? Well, one thing that's different between mitral and tufted cells that we've recognized, or Izumi has recognized a couple of years ago, is that although both mitral and tufted cells reliably sync to the respiratory, to the sniff rhythm, they do so preferring different phases. This is data in the anesthetized animal. So they prefer either the inhalation phase in case of mitral cells or the exhalation phase in case of the tufted cells. And that's a very robust phenomenon among these 15 cells. We've reconstructed morphologies. There was no overlap between the two populations. Very clean preference of exhalation or inhalation between tufted and mitral cells. So now let's for a second assume it would be the same in the awake animal, although we haven't shown that directly. Well, then it would make sense to actually look at the cells I showed you earlier and look at their phase preference. Do they prefer 5 minutes? Yeah. Do they prefer exhalation or do they prefer inhalation? In this study and in a follow-up study last year, we showed that this phase shift between mitral and tufted cells is can be quite robustly explained by strong feed-forward inhibition onto mitral cells and more direct excitation on tufted cells. And we sort of interfered specifically, first pharmacologically, but then specifically with glomerular inhibition and showed that we could make mitral cells more look like tufted cells. If this model is true, I think it might be attractive to think what happens with more input. We might get more excitation here, but we might get more inhibition for mitral cells. So if we now spread out these cells that I just showed you, where we looked at the change in response with the change in sniff rate, and spread them along the respiration cycle, we do see quite a nice pattern, namely that some cells that lie in the phase that corresponds, if we make this an analogy to the anesthetized, that corresponds to mitral cells, tend to show largely hyperpolarization, whereas cells that lie in this different phase, the tufted cell phase, show largely depolarization. And if we throw in, these are awake behaving data, if we throw in awake passive data as well, it seems to be very consistent that depending on the phase of oscillation of respiration a cell prefers, it either depolarizes or hyperpolarizes in response to changes in sniff rate. So the explanation of this heterogeneity might be simply that these are tufted cells and these are mitral cells. But we haven't shown that yet, and I was hoping for morphologies to be reconstructed this morning, but apparently that hadn't happened. So hopefully maybe by next week I can give a bit better. So I think this is a strong argument also for that this phase separation might hold in the awake animal, might help for classifying cells, also for many of you potentially doing unit recordings. So how does sniffing, so I made a point that sniffing instructs a lot of activity in the olfactory, in mitral and tufted cells. How does sniffing now change over the course of learning? Well, first thing, for these CS minus trial here, this example, actually sniff rate essentially doesn't change over the course of the entire 40 trials. We looked at 3.5 hertz in the beginning, 3.5 hertz late. However, in this example of the same animal as plus CS plus trials, there was a robust increase in sniff frequency from the beginning to the end, from 3 hertz to something like 5 hertz. Again, let's look at population data, and pretty much again, like in the changes in responses, it's a bit of a mess. In some cases, sniff rate increases by a few hertz, in some cases it decreases by a few hertz. So what about if this mess has something to do with this mess? If actually the variability in responses we see during learning simply reflects the variability in sniff rate, that sniff rate is changes as a consequence of having detected an odorant in a differential yet to be understood way. So a simple experiment to do is correlate changes in sniff rate with correlated in membrane potential change. If we do that for the CS plus trials, we see a weak correlation. That's, where's Kevin? Kevin, yeah, it's not significant, as you alluded to earlier. Probably I'm not going to show anything significant. So there's a weak correlation between a change in memory potential and a change in SNF rate. If we do the same thing for the S-minus trials, again, there's a trend in pretty much the same direction. But, I mean, why separate CS-plus and CS-minus trials if the hypothesis is simply they change sniffing for whatever reason, and that results in a change in memory potential? If you lump together all this data, we now get something that approaches a significant relation between a change in memory potential and the change in sniff rate. But we're only explaining quite a small fraction of the variance. In particular, there are a couple of dots that are just annoyingly out of place. But again, remind yourself that I'm lumping together all cells we recorded, mitral-tufted cells, and mitral and tufted cells. And in the last data slide I'm going to show, let's try to separate now this data based on the preferred phase. And if we plot the preferred phase, something preferring exhalation or preferring inhalation, see that cells that show a robust positive correlation between change in memory potential and change in sniff rate, while in this corner are all in the reddish side preferring inhalation, whereas these cells all prefer exhalation. And in a nutshell, if we separate by putative mitral and tufted cells, we see quite a strong correlation that explains a significant portion of the variability in recording, a variability in odor responses, the change in odor responses that is simply due to a change in sniff rate. And interestingly, we see the opposite relation for putative tufted cells, although a substantially weaker correlation. So I think changes in sniffing can at least partially, if not to a large extent, explain potential changes in response. So in a nutshell, I think what I'm trying to say, the olfactory bulb is actually substantially simpler than one might want to look at. It doesn't change particularly from the anesthetized to the awake. There are subtle changes that are probably very important, but overall, the biophysics, the system stays the same. And even if the animal is learning, it will change behavior, it will change sniffing, but that sniffing might actually happen after the animal has detected, but the basic response might be quite stable. So with that, I want to obviously thank the key people, and think all the awake hat fixed behaving data was from Vacu, or within, I don't know, 6 months into a PhD, managed to do that, and is now kind of confused how easy it seems to be. Fair enough. I don't think I would have to tell that anyone else. And obviously, Izumi and Mihai have been the key postdocs in the lab, for many of you know them very well. And funding, and I should point out, funding the Medical Research Council over the last 2 years, and now obviously Francis Crick Institute, and that is the futuristic, beautiful building, and my office is going to be out here somewhere looking out of London. So thank you very much.
Hey, that was very nice. So it's been shown that head-fixed animals do have different kind of sniffing patterns, right, in response to odors. So what do you think the differences might be between a freely moving animal and the head-fixed?
Fair enough. That's the next thing we need to try. But So I mean, with the difference between head-fixed and freely moving, I usually kind of retract to the point that I have a behavior I want to understand, namely the animal is able to learn to discriminate odorants, and I want to understand how the circuitry does it. It might be a valid question to ask whether the circuitry would do it the same way if it's freely moving, but I think then we have to ask whether the freely moving is an ethological situation or whether the mice we're working in are actually ethologically relevant mice or not. So I think I'd rather work with the head fixed, and it's pretty clear that it's going to be slightly different in the freely moving.
So here, are you familiar with the work on insects where the conditional stimulus connected with the biogenic amine, octopamine, mm-hmm. release at the same time when they receive the order and they remember? So do you know any pharmacology about this situation? Because
about how the association is made?
Yeah, because it's just like direct analogy with the insects. So I presented the poster here with the noradrenaline, which is analogous.
I mean, I think in my very naive way, ignoring all neuromodulation, my very distant view, and anyone here is more competent than me to comment on that, it seems that pretty much any neuromodulator, if you mess with that up heavily enough in the olfactory bulb, seems to impact on some aspects of that learning process. But I wouldn't want to go any closer to that.
Also, sniffing, there'll be a modulation by the, well, you told that for any reason, they change their interest, but sniffing by itself, can be modulated by them.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, maybe we can talk about it in more detail later, but no. Ron.
So Andreas, those sniffing phase-induced activity seems to be passive, right? So you can do tracheotomy and then still can change the frequency and then induce it. So mechanistically, how do you think that this sort of impose this phase onto the intrinsic property?
I mean, I think the what we think we understand reasonably well is why mitral and tufted cells prefer different phases. What happens there is that there is that mitral cells under many circumstances are dominated by feed-forward inhibition that essentially delays them. So if you block inhibition, they become earlier. We haven't tried to take a model like this explicitly and increase sniff frequency and see whether that would result in DN hyperpolarizations. So far this was kind of a motivation to think maybe there is, what was Becky's idea. Becky looked at that paper and said maybe this heterogeneity comes from that, and she looked at that, and there seems to be a very clear phase correlation. Interestingly, I think I also want to point out a potential flaw in that logic, namely that these correlations, if I had to have drawn them earlier, I would have expected them to be the other way around, because with mitral cells for without odor exposure, what we see is that increased sniffing actually hyperpolarizes the cell, whereas for tufted cells it's the opposite. So. But we have to get morphologies here to verify what we're doing. There's still some inconsistencies in that.
And you think it's more of a mechanical stimulation that that drives the...
That drives the oscillations in the input. I mean, I think from Xavier Gromaitre's work and others, I think it seems quite clear that there are a subset of olfactory receptors that are stretch sensitive, right? Not all, to my understanding, but a subset. But a subset, I think.
Very beautiful. I'd be interested in just hearing thoughts on whether, to the extent that there are sort of differences in how much we think the awake state, for example, matters, what's the likelihood that it comes down essentially to sort of the sampling of cells? So meaning you've taken a very, if I understand correctly, very unbiased approach. So you're kind of dominated by what the typical cell does. And to the extent that maybe extracellular recording may or may not be biased towards sort of the faster firing cells, is there room for that kind of thing to explain some of the potential differences or
I mean, I think one thing is quite clear to me is the imaging data, that in particular Takaki's data, when the small point of that beautiful neuron paper, where they looked at different anesthetized and awake, but average across 10 seconds. So if we do exactly the same plot, so these are difference between awake and anesthetized if we just look at 1 second in our case, but if we now look at the response as 10 seconds after minus 8 seconds before, like they did, we do see the same kind of profile that they observe. But that's simply because these long-lasting responses that go on for seconds are there in the anesthetized and not in the awake. With respect to the firing rates from unit recordings, I mean, Dima would be one of the people to discuss that with in detail. I mean, I think if one preferentially samples high-firing cells, then the top 10% are very, very different. It's the tail of this distribution. I think with general rhodopsin selected unit recordings, you comment whether firing rates are the same or not.
I have a rather naive question. There are a couple of papers recently that show that by imaging, if you entrain an animal, the glomeruli that respond to the specific odor have much higher activity.
I think none of them really looks with a wish to find differences in sniffing. So I think fear conditioning, I don't know whether fear conditioning in a head-fixed animal will result in massive changes in sniff rate. If it's lightly anesthetized, it definitely will change. If you change sniff rate substantially, you will see a change in... I mean, if it's glomerulus-specific, I think it's a bit more difficult to just explain it by changes in sniff rate. But if I want a uninteresting explanation. I would say things can be explained a lot by changes in sniff rate. And also, I mean, we have to pay keep in mind that one only needs to look at the first or second inhalation or exhalation. So it's not if you average sniff rate over 10 seconds. On average, it might be sufficiently variable that you lose your ability to detect differences. But the behaviorally relevant stretch would be sort of the first. We were thinking when we looked at and found these relatively strong correlations, we were thinking to revisit some of that work. And we should say we looked with great. Becky really wants to find cells that robustly change during learning, not due to sniffing. But she can't find a single cell where she sees a significant deviation in membrane potential before the respective inhalation or exhalation is also significantly changed. So if there's an early change in membrane potential during learning, like after 300 milliseconds or so, then rest assured that the corresponding first inhalation was already shorter. So I think that doesn't prove that it's a change in sniff rate, but it also doesn't. We don't have any examples that it's not.
Before I give it to Dima, I just want to make sure. I think Stavros is pointing to these changes, the fear condition. That's happening over days, looking at before and after days. Your changes, you're looking at 20-minute, 30-minute changes.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think we should be very clear.
Yeah. No, but I think one needs to still know whether just the animals learned a different sniff pattern.
Very beautiful work. I very, very impressed. I heard this story about what puzzling, it's still puzzling that we've been recording probably the most strong firing rate cells. It's still mystery because, you know, from the why this selection in the extracellular recording. Now, just to comment that we start recording with channel adoption identifiable cell and distribution is much broader than previously. We see a low firing rate, but not quantified yet. So the truth somewhere in the middle. I don't know what the biases are, honestly speaking.
I mean, it's possible also that it's slightly different cell populations. I mean, the assumption is that all mitral cells are the same, but we've done some, maybe I'm going to talk about that next week, done some electroporation and find some heterogeneity in morphologies as well.
That the only thing that biases may go both ways. Maybe there is some selection in which cells is easier to patch. But the some cells are easier to record extracellularly.
Yeah,
so it's not one-way road.
I also want to kind of make that point clear. I'm not saying we have unbiased recordings. What I'm saying is we have recordings that are not biased by firing rate. So I think we are biased for a specific morphology potentially. But within that morphological class, I can't see how we should pick the high-firing cells versus the low-firing cells or the other way around.
We're also not biased by the firing rate because we would detect low firing rate. In the previous work, now we do much more target recordings.
The question was, do you guys record from the same region?
I think most of our recordings are dorsal and anterior lateral dorsal. And I think in your case, it's largely.
It was a long time ago, I don't remember.
How are you doing?
We should all record from the M72.
we should probably just go.
Well, thanks a lot. Thank you.
I mean, you could ask questions while I guess Nima is setting up the.
Yes.
Or we can make them fight or something.